So I want to welcome you to the 437th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. It's nice to see all of you here today and to welcome those listening on the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine. And I'm George Look, president of the Forum. We are pleased to again be holding our monthly meetings. Forum meetings began in 1983 to hear invited experts talk about and answer questions about issues critical to the formulation of U.S. foreign policy. Forum meetings are still providing citizens with the opportunity to learn about and to discuss the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies and factors influencing them. Details about the forum, audios of our past talks, information about upcoming programs, and information on how to become a forum member are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. We're very pleased today to have Mr. Mitchell Zukov with us to speak on 20 years after 9/11, the lessons and legacy of the attack. Given the recent events in Afghanistan and the uncertain future in that part of the world, this topic is now certainly of renewed importance. Mr. Mitchell Zukov is the Sumner E. Redstone Professor of Narrative Studies at Boston University and the author of 8 nonfiction books. His most recent book is the New York Times bestselling Rise and Fall, Fall and Rise, Fall and Rise, the story of 9/11. His previous books have also been New York Times bestsellers, have been the basis for major movies, and have won prestigious awards for nonfiction work. He has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, and numerous other publications. As a member of the Boston Globe Spotlight team, Mr. Zukov was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. As a National Special Projects reporter, he wrote the lead story, news story, for the Boston Globe on 9/11, and he led a team of journalists who wrote about the attacks, the victims, and the perpetrators. His honors include the American Society of Newspaper Editors Distinguished Writing Award, the Livingston Award for International Reporting, and the Haywood Brown Award. He shared the Associated Press Managing Editors Award for Public Service. Mitch, it is a pleasure to welcome you to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you, George. I appreciate it. Thank you, George, and thank you all for having me here. It's always my ambition to be in the top 500 of something, and so being 437th, I feel like I've already won the day. I first have to acknowledge my friend and one of my mentors, Matt Storin. I wouldn't be here if not for Matt's leadership of the Boston Globe and the support that he showed to me and to my wife, Suzanne Kreider, a photographer at the paper, during crucial moments in our career. George mentioned the Spotlight team being a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Matt was the editor who stood behind us through that project. Matt sort of, you know, ran the room as well as anybody possibly could have and anybody ever has. And so I'm honored to be here at his table. Thanks, Matt. Oh, good, yeah, leave the 20. So I'm gonna talk a bit about 9/11, and from looking out at the crowd, clearly you're all much too young to have a memory of the event. So I'll try to bring you back to that day a bit. And we can also talk about the policy implications, but most of my work is as a narrative writer. I tell big stories in small ways, and often through the people for whom it was an intimate, life-changing moment in many ways. I did the same, as George mentioned, one of my previous books was about a different 9/11 event, Benghazi, which as you know, happened on 9/11/2012. And so I told that story the same way. So I'm gonna start by telling you a little bit about a fellow named Dave Tarantino. And it's a name I imagine most of you don't know, if any. And I believe it's a name that should be known to every American and beyond. On 9/11, Dave Tarantino was a Navy doctor based at the Pentagon. he had he was in a moment of transition, deciding whether or not he was going to stay in the service, and he was weighing it out because he was deciding whether to become a family physician. And before I tell you what happened to Dave that day, you need to know a few things about him. Number one, he was someone who knew what it felt like quite viscerally to be in tremendous need of saving. When he was a college rower at Stanford, he and some friends had gone out on a kind of a ricky-ticky skydiving company's flight. He jumped out and his parachute only partially opened. He landed in a field and half his body was crushed. So he went from college athlete to being near death. And he spent years rebuilding his body, endless rowing, endless leg press, you name it. So he knew what it was like to be desperate. The second was, while he was recovering at that pivotal moment in his life, he read the book Lord Jim, Conrad's Lord Jim, some of you may know. And Dave was, as you know, sort of at different points in our life, I think we're sort of open to certain literature. And at that moment, Dave really just was taken by Lord Jim's shame at having saved himself when his ship was afire and not going back to save others, those of you who know the work. And the third thing you need to know about Dave is that some of you I know are in the service, and I thank you for it. Dave really internalized the Navy ethos that aboard ship, every sailor is a firefighter. And so on 9/11, Dave's ship was the Pentagon, and so he saw himself that way. So when Flight 77 hit the Pentagon, it burrowed into the Navy Command Center on the first floor of the Pentagon. Some of you, I imagine, know the Pentagon. It is a series of five rings. It's not just five stories. It's actually five-sided. Five is everything. So the five rings. He was quite far from the area where the Pentagon was hit. But all of those factors, I think both consciously and subconsciously, played upon Dave at that moment. And so he moved closer and closer toward the flames. And the main internal area where you can move around, it's kind of an internal roadway open to the sky, is called AE Drive in the Pentagon. He reached AE Drive and saw a hole in the wall where smoke was pouring out. Now, Dave could have been a hero that day. He was a physician. If he had gone, at the center of the Pentagon, there's a courtyard. If he had gone to the courtyard and triaged patients, he would have been a hero that day because people were fleeing for their lives. But he didn't. He kept going, and he found this hole where the nose of the plane, or what remained of the plane, had punched through into AE Drive. And smoke was pouring out. A few stragglers were pouring out of that place. And he went in and realized that this might be an escape route for people who might be trapped. So he went deeper and deeper into the ground zero, if you will, of the Pentagon. That was the point of contact, the point of impact. And wires are arcing. There's water dripping from broken pipes. It's a skiff. Much of the area is a skiff, a secure compartmentalized information facility for security reasons. So it's wired all over, and the wires are melting and poking holes, little burn holes in his shirt as he goes deeper and deeper into this fiery cauldron. And he gets farther in and he sees this giant Navy SEAL, this guy Craig Powell, and he's holding up one piece of the ceiling because there's a couple of people farther in. He wants to help them out. And this massive Navy SEAL is holding up the building, and Dave goes further in. And he finds a guy named Dave Thomas who is trying to help a retired naval aviator named Jerry Henson, who's pinned under a desk and file cabinets and you name it, under hundreds of pounds. And the building is creaking. It feels like it's about to collapse on them. And Dave Tarantino realizes what's happening. He goes in, he flips onto his back, And those leg presses I told you about, the endless rebuilding, he puts the soles of his melting shoes, they're literally melting, on the underside of this desk to try to free Jerry Henson, who had come back to the Pentagon after his retirement, so he was an older fellow. And he starts to press, to lift up these hundreds of pounds of furniture that are pinning Jerry down as the building's about to collapse. Why don't I leave you there for a minute? Matt will tell you, I'm not a nice guy. So that's this kind of storytelling to try and draw in people like my students. As George mentioned, I'm a professor now at Boston University, and I do teach students now who were not just don't have any memories, but they simply weren't alive at 9/11. I'm teaching my first class of sophomores who were not born on 9/11, which is just so good for how I feel about it as a young man. But this is why I told Fall and Rise the way I did, because there's always a moment in time when news, which is, I was originally in the news business, that's where my heart is, where news becomes history, and history is what happened to other people. And so my philosophy in writing this book was to make it as present, as immediate, as someone telling you a story about Dave Tarantino or about Elaine Duke on the 88th floor of the North Tower opening a doorway and being consumed by flames, or and on and on and on. And those are the stories that collectively, within the larger story of what happened on 9/11, is what I decided I needed to tell. And the reason I needed to tell it was about 5 or 6 years ago, I realized, to my shock, a book like this didn't exist. There was an entire bookshelf of 9/11 related books, and a lot of them are really quite wonderful. If you haven't read The Looming Tower, if you haven't read 102 Minutes, there's some really great works around these events. But nobody had tried to tell a full narrative of what happened that day. All four planes, sort of, you know, all four destination points, the military and the government, you know, the chaotic military and government response. So that was the task I set for myself. The other reason I thought it was necessary to do this is because, again, this descent of news into history, that names are news. That's one of the first things we learn as journalists. And I realized that, you know, the best known name of 9/11, arguably, was Osama bin Laden, which didn't make sense to me. I thought if we can resurrect names like Dave Tarantino and others, there would be value there. You know, there's a brief moment in time when the people who could tell me these stories, who witnessed these events or experienced these events, wouldn't be here for that, you know, forever. A book like this cannot be told even now. A number of the people who I interviewed, and I interviewed literally hundreds of people for this book, have since passed. I've been, you know, in touch with many of them ever since. And I realize, my goodness, that may have been their last opportunity to tell what happened that day. And finally, I fear that 9/11 is becoming what we used to call, again, at the Globe, a numbers story. Obviously, you have 9 and 11. You've got four planes, 19 hijackers, twin towers, a Pentagon. You know, it becomes a math problem when it's really something else entirely. So whatever skills that I may have, I thought, could be well spent trying to bring this book to life and bring the story to life. And it really dates back exactly 20 years ago now. On 9/11, as George mentioned, I was working on my first book. I had done a major project for the Boston Globe that Matt had championed, called Choosing Naya, a story of a family deciding whether to continue a pregnancy knowing that their child would have Down syndrome and a severe heart defect. And it turned into a long-term series we did for the Globe. And I was turning that into my first book. So I was home, you know, in a pink robe and fuzzy slippers, because I was now an author. Matt wasn't going to, you know, see me, presumably. And so the first plane goes in, and I go right into kind of a pedantic mode of explaining to my wife, well, you know, hon, because I was a history buff, you know, right after World War II, a bomber hit the Empire State Building. This thing, kind of thing happens once, you know. And of course, as I'm droning on, the second plane, United 175, hits the South Tower. And I run for the phone. And before I get there, it's ringing, and it's a fellow named Mark Morrow, who was a national editor. And he just had one quick message: your book leaves over, get your ass in here. And so that was my 9/11 story, and I know that all of you have a 9/11 story of where you were when you heard, and you'll always remember that, or maybe some of you were affected by it personally. Those of us at the Globe very quickly realized that no matter what else we would find out, and we had neighbors, we knew of people. One of our colleagues, David Filipov, his father Al, was on the first plane, was on United 11. So we immediately knew this was a story that was going to be a global story as well as a really intimate local story, if you will. We were going to be writing about our neighbors who were on the first two planes to hit the towers. So I spent that day, I had done that kind of work before. I had written the lead stories when JFK Jr.'s plane went down. I was the lead reporter for the Globe at Columbine. I had been called upon to do that kind of work. And so fairly quickly it was decided, above my pay grade, that Zukov is going to write today. And so I wrote the lead story that day with the help of dozens of incredible colleagues. So that was a 16-hour day. I did leave my fuzzy slippers at home, fortunately. Next day, came in, did the same thing. The next day, I said, well, why don't we try to do something extraordinary, if we can? And I knew I had extraordinary reporters available to me. Why don't we try to do a narrative? Why don't we try to do one of the first narratives of 9/11? Because the Globe, historically, has been a writer's newspaper, a place where people who care deeply about nonfiction writing can do the work as journalists. And so this was very much in the tradition of the paper. And so I pitched an idea in the news meeting, in the Winship room, that if you give me some reporters, we're going to tell the first narrative of what happened to three people on the first plane and three people in and around the first tower. And we called it Six Lives. And with the help of four remarkable reporters, we told the story that started like this. A farmer who flew jets, a businesswoman, a rookie stockbroker, a secretary, an EMT, a hijacker. Six strangers. At 8:44 a.m. Tuesday, three were in the air aboard American Airlines Flight 11. Three were in New York. 1 minute later, Flight 11 slammed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center. Those six lives became forever intertwined. When the orange fireball gave way to cold gray ash, three were dead, two by murder, one by suicide. A fourth was missing, and two had faced death, but had somehow survived. The crash of Flight 11 was followed in quick succession by three other jets hijacked to oblivion. But it was the first blow that woke the world to an invasion of terror and to stories of close calls, last words, and lost dreams. And then I interwove the story of these six people. Starting with John Oganowski, the pilot of Flight 11, whose wife, whose widow, Peg, remains a friend to this day. So that was the scale model of the book that I had hoped, that I decided I wanted to try to write in time for the 20th anniversary. In the meantime, I went on, wrote these other books, did these other things, but 9/11 always stayed with me. So once I decided to start working on this, monumental doesn't begin to describe the task. I thought I would made a monumental mistake. That was the first use of the word monumental. I needed to create my own authoritative timeline. There are so many conspiracy theories out there. There are so many sort of false truths out there about 9/11 that I felt like I needed to start from a place of certainty about everything that could be known. And so with the help of a fantastic research assistant named Sarah Kess, I spent over a year just building a timeline, doing nothing but building a timeline and overlaying multiple timelines upon it. This was a technique that I had learned, actually, at the Globe and the Spotlight team. We want to sort of define our universe before we start to dissect it. And so I knew what was happening, for instance, and I'll talk about this in a minute, at exactly 9:30 and 30 seconds in about 15 different places, including what was happening on Air Force One, what was happening inside each of the buildings that had been hit, and on from there. And so the second thing I had to do was sort of pull upon my investigative skills. So I was trying to figure out, you know, what happened? What are some of the takeaway big themes that I can explore here that might be useful to foreign policy folks, to emergency responders, what have you? And, you know, again and again, and one theme that I won't belabor here, but is the failures. This was a failure of communication, on every level. Just to be clear, the full blame for what happened on 9/11 obviously belongs with Al-Qaeda and the terrorists who carried out bin Laden's scheme. But the fact that the New York Fire Department, FDNY, could not speak, literally could not speak, was on a different wavelength, frequency, than the NYPD is shocking to me, even after the 93 events, were the first time that it was hit. The fact that the State Department had a 60,000 name no-fly list, or watch list, it was a watch list, and two of those names were Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midhar, who were two of the hijackers, were on the State Department's list. And the head of civil aviation security for the FAA did not know such a list even existed. There were 12 names on 9/11/01. There were 12 names on the FAA's no-fly list. Our own government wasn't speaking to each other. So the FAA didn't know that the State Department had such a list, and two of the names, who are the most, in some ways, the most notorious even of the 19 because of their specific ties to the Saudi government, are still being explored to this day. So I wanted to figure out, how do I weave that in to the stories of Dave, the stories of Elaine, the stories of the Hansen family, whose story just almost breaks me every time I tell it, even after all these years, that Eunice and Lee Hansen are a couple in Easton, Connecticut, and their son, Peter, and daughter-in-law, Sue Kim, and their granddaughter, Christine, who was two, were on the second flight. They were going out to California on business and also to go to Disney World, because she was two. And Peter got off two calls to his father, Lee, that day from the back of the plane. And first Peter told Lee, "We've been hijacked, call the police," and or call the airline. And they hung up, and Lee did. Lee got through to the police and reported what was happening on flight 175 as it was happening. Peter called a second time and was huddling in the back of the plane with his wife and two-year-old daughter, who was the youngest victim of 9/11. And he was having another call with his father when the plane hit the South Tower. And so I had the privilege and the responsibility of sitting in Lee and Eunice's house in the kitchen where Lee took that call, and then Eunice inviting me up to Peter's bedroom, his boyhood bedroom that she had preserved, to tell the story of who her son was. So I have to work in, you know, if I'm doing my job, I have to tell that emotional story alongside this story that's infuriating about, you know, agencies that don't communicate. So all that has to work together. And finally, to tell a story like this, I need the trust of people like Eunice and Lee of a fella named Ron Clifford, who, if he wasn't real, you would think I'm making this up. This is a guy who, on that day, how do I interconnect all these different events happening in literally 9 different locations, if you think about it, 4 different planes, 4 different endpoints, and then the big government military response, I always considered a kind of a location. And then there's Ron Clifford. He's a category of one on the planet. He was supposed to be in Midtown for the meeting that he thought was the biggest meeting of his life, business meeting, and at the last minute gets changed to the Marriott that was between the Twin Towers. And so he is there that morning waiting to go up to his meeting to meet with the guy who's gonna buy his company. And he's in the men's room straightening his tie that his beloved sister had picked out for him because it was so important, his yellow tie. And Ron goes out of the men's room to the marble floor of the big lobby and suddenly sees, doesn't know what's happening. Burned people are coming in to the lobby and people are stampeding. And he sees one woman, Jenny Ann Maffeo, and everyone is running past her. Ron helps her to the ground. And if you know anything about burn victims, often before the pain, before the real awful stuff sets in, they're in shock. And she was able to communicate all this important information to him, to give, to here are my parents' names, here's my sister's name, this is where I work, I have an allergy to latex, all these things. And then after he had written all of this down, Ron is on the floor of the Marriott with her, and they're saying the Lord's Prayer, because he realized they share a faith. And as they're saying the Lord's Prayer, something happens and something hits the South Tower. They find out later it's 175. And they feel the vibration literally come down the building and up through the floor as they're saying the Lord's Prayer. Ron would only find out later that day that that sister I mentioned and her daughter was on that flight. So Ron was a first responder, a survivor, a family victim. He's a category of one. And it's my greatest hope that, Ron, will you trust me? Will you allow me to sort of tear open this wound and spend a few days with you talking about your life before and after and during these events? And having to do that for literally dozens and dozens of people. And incredibly, overwhelmingly, they said yes. They understood that this was important enough to put themselves back through the pain, back through the excruciating day and the aftermath. Almost everyone said yes. One who said no, I've always found particularly intriguing. There's another very tiny category, an extraordinary category of people where both members of a couple, both the male and female members of a couple, were inside one of the towers, and one survived and one didn't. And so I wanted to tell a story of a couple torn asunder by this. And one such couple, and I'm not even going to say the gender because it's really a small category, and I don't want to identify this person, was fine with it. And we were going back and forth, and this person was going to tell me their story. And then I said, well, I really want to start on September 10th. I need to do this story right. We can't just sort of tell the story of what happened to you when the worst thing happened. We want to make, what was life like before when your biggest worry was the kids' homework or the renovation that's going on in your bathroom that's the contractor doesn't show up? You know, the normal hassles of life and the beauty part of life in many ways. And that was the break point for this person. They could go back to September 11th and talk about everything from there on, but they couldn't go back to September 10th and open up that wound. And so I ended up fortunately finding a different couple who fit that description, who ended up being remarkable. She was in the tower, he was a first responder. And so Carlos and Cece are in the book. So I've done all this. I've done all this reporting. This is now 3+ years in to this work. And then I come upon this, for all writers, the question, you know, writing is structure, whether it's on a sentence-by-sentence structural basis, but the big structure is how am I going to design this in a way that makes it usable and readable and engaging? Because even though you know the outcome of the big story, you don't know what's going to happen to Ron or to Jenny Ann or to, you know, obviously you know what's going to happen to the people on the planes. You can't really suspend disbelief for that. So as I'm doing this, I'm struggling because it's chaos. Things are happening in 9 places at once with people who don't intertwine with other people. And I come upon what I came to be to consider as the 9:35 problem. And this crystallized it for me, that at 9:35 that morning, everything was happening. And this was the evil, I hate to use the word genius, but this was the evil design of the terrorists, of the hijackers, that if they could do everything so quickly before any meaningful response could be mounted, that would be that would increase their likelihood of success. So if you think about 9:35 on 9/11, 3 planes at this point have actually already been hijacked. 2 have already crashed. Flight 77 is just moments from Washington hitting the Pentagon. Flight 93 has just had its last routine communication with flight controllers, and the first sign of trouble has just been. And I imagine you know the story of the Flight 93, and that delay, because they took off late, was how the heroes, the 40 heroes of Flight 93, were able to have the first uprising, the first battle against the terrorists. 2 of the towers are burning. The first firefighter, Danny Sir, has just been killed by a person who either fell or jumped from the tower. Jets have been scrambled. Fighter jets have been scrambled. Military is trying to desperately to catch up. Kevin Nisipany, who is a subject of the book, he is running our response that morning from a bunker in upstate New York. And Kevin has just said the words, "I don't care how many windows you break." He's just told his fighter jets, go supersonic, get to Washington to set up a combat air patrol over the city, because we don't know how many more there are out there. President Bush has just been informed, he has just spoken to the nation, and he is racing at this moment to Air Force One. 30 years into my career, I couldn't untangle that into a narrative. It was too much going on. There's no way to sort of keep track of all those things happening in a deeply human way. And that's where the story becomes fall and rise. So the book's title lends itself to the structure that I ended up choosing. And what that means is, first, I tell the story of fall from the sky, the events in the air, and the people who are affected immediately, including the Hansen family and Peg Oganowski's husband and all those other people, and our friend Dave Filipov's father and all those other people on the planes. And then I tell the story, fall to the ground, what happens in the buildings, in the termination points. And so I restart the clock. So there are 2 narrative arcs. And then, because I do believe this, rise from the ashes, the aftermath, an extended epilogue of what happened to all these people who did survive, or the families who had to deal with the absence of their loved ones. And so that was the story I set out to write. And fortunately, above all, the people who were at the center of it, I want to make sure there's time for questions, I know, trusted me, and including Dave Tarantino. So I owe you, I guess, the end of that story. It seems only right. You paid for lunch, so. Dave was able to squirrel his way under the furniture that was pinning Jerry Henson and got his shoes up on this furniture. And it was hundreds and hundreds of pounds. And was able to lift it just a few inches off of Jerry Henson, and he was able to sort of pull Jerry across his body and drag him out of this little cubbyhole office in the Navy Command Center. And with Craig Powell, the giant SEAL, and Dave Thomas, who later became an admiral, they were the last people to exit the Pentagon before that side of the building did in fact collapse. Jerry and Dave stayed in touch for many years. Dave ended up deciding to stay in the Navy because that's where he thought he could do the most good in the world. And he and Jerry would run into each other. Dave has twin daughters, and Jerry has had a granddaughter, a beloved granddaughter, who's extremely close to. And he would take her to swim at the same sort of community pool where Dave took his daughters to swim. And so they would see each other regularly. And a couple years ago, I got a call from Jerry's wife that Jerry had passed. And she wanted me to know that at his funeral at Arlington, Dave had walked behind the caisson, the horse-drawn funeral procession in full uniform. And, the family just, they love Jerry, they love Dave like another son, because he gave Jerry 16 years with that granddaughter that he would not have had if he had hesitated even for literally 1 minute, less than a minute, was between the time he got him out and the time that building collapsed. Those are the stories that I'm happy to talk foreign policy, and I'm happy to talk geopolitics, but the reason why I'm here, I think, in a sort of, for me, a kind of an existential sense, is to try and preserve stories like that that illuminate the personal forces that are, or the personal stories that are affected by geopolitics. Before I turn it over to questions, maybe I should just end on Dave, but the strangest talk of my career, I think, happened earlier this year on this very subject because of the 20th anniversary. So I got a call from the NSA asking me, would you come and talk to us? And if you know, the NSA is basically the CIA for electronic communications. They do all the SIGINT, the signal intelligence of, and it's multiple times the size of the CIA. And so I said, sure. And they said, yeah, but we can't tell you where you're coming. Okay. And we can't tell you when. I said, this is going to be hard to speak here. I'm not that good. I'm a good investigative reporter. I'm not going to beat the NSA at your own, tell me. So finally we ended up doing it by Zoom. And it was fantastic because all of the blocks, instead of the normal Zoom wave that we now do to everyone, it was all blacked out silhouettes with fake names. And so I have no idea if I was speaking to them or to if this was like a prank by a bunch of really clever kids at MIT, but I was fine either way. So there you go. So you got the same thing the NSA or MIT got. So take of that what you will. Thank you.
Mitch, the way we do this is that we collect questions from the floor, and I'll kind of sort through them. That way we can sometimes combine a bunch of questions and give one that you can address.
Terrific.
Thank you. It was very, very interesting. Actually, 9/11 has a special meaning to me. I was in the Pentagon at the time.
Oh, my.
And exited through the exit that was closest to where the plane...
Wow, George.
Yes. It was quite an experience, I have to tell you.
Oh.
But I don't want to go through that now. I've been through it once already. I usually take the advantage of the fact that it takes a little time to get questions up here to ask the first question. And I'm going to turn things a little more toward the international or the terrorism part of that. What is your view of what bin Laden's real goal was, and did he meet it? Did he meet his expectations? Did he
that's a great
was
question.
It greater?
So you know that his fatwa of 1998 was largely ignored. He explained exactly what he wanted to do, and I don't think he was successful. I mean, what he wanted to do was get American forces out of Saudi Arabia and out of, you know, away from Mecca and Medina and out of the Middle East in general. And he also wanted, he said, although I think people are right to have skepticism about this, whether he was truly supportive of the Palestinian cause. I think that's open to interpretation to this day. You know, certainly he achieved his momentary goals, but no, I do not for a second believe he achieved his larger goals of, I guess ISIS to some extent was an outgrowth of his goals, but no, I do not believe so.
Here's one that I think I had myself, and it came up from the floor as well. From what you know, could this happen again? What has changed with our systems, intelligence, et cetera, that would either keep this from happening again or would mitigate the effects?
Sure. It's a great question, and I think smarter people than I have devoted their lives to it. I think there's no question that something like a model of this will not happen again. I think, you know, but we tend to, as most of us know, we end up fighting the last war. We've done a very good job of eliminating this particular threat, but we haven't necessarily gamed out all the other potential threats, whether it's a dirty bomb, whether it's, you know, some other version of this. So I do feel, you know, I fly confidently, and I don't think that's the threat. Well, I'd love to tell when people ask me that kind of question is, you have to remember, so the fighter pilots who are over DC, who Kevin Isipany is telling to break windows, one of them is picked up on the radio, on his mic, and he says something to the effect of the bastards snuck one by us. What he's saying is, he thinks that the Russians have sent a cruise missile. He is literally responding to 9/11 an hour after it's happened. This is about 9:30, and he's still fighting the last war, quite literally. He was not informed of what exactly was the mission he was responding to. He was just told to put a cap up over D.C. So I think we do tend, I think there's pretty good evidence that he literally was fighting the last war in the middle of it. To some extent, I suspect we are still doing the same thing.
Interesting. Our talk last month was by someone saying we're always fighting the last war. Here's an example. Even in a terrorist situation.
We did not set this up, right.
Even in a terrorist situation, we're fighting the last war. Here's a kind of a follow-up to that. You alluded to the failure of communications between the fire department and the police. Did that get fixed?
Yes.
And is it fixed? Is it fixed everywhere, or is it only in New York City?
That is fixed, and it has become. And fortunately, there's a wonderful guy, a fire. He was a deputy commissioner, I think, when he retired. Joe Pfeiffer has made it his life's work to go around the country and to sort of have standards of practice of emergency response. And so that has become codified, I think, in all major departments. And I have to give credit to Chief Pfeiffer.
And here's one that's specific to kind of the hijacking situation in general. What should the U.S. Air Force do in situations of a hijacking? Hmm. What have they learned since 9/11 about the response, the initial response?
I did not serve in the military, so I'm always very careful. The guy who wrote Black Hawk Down, Mark Bowden, was always very careful as well, and I sort of learned from Mark that, you know, I'm not the right person to be prescriptive of how the military should respond. So I hope you'll accept that. One thing I will say is that, again, it goes back to fighting the last war. If you think about what our capacity was on 9/11, we had largely mothballed our fighters on 9/11. The military had decided that the Russian threat was not that great, and so we had very few active available fighter jets that day. I think, you know, just in general, I think it's a fair point that other people have made that readiness has to be at a much higher level than it was on 9/11.
And you alluded to Saudi Arabia earlier in the answer to another question. And here's one. What was the role of Saudi Arabia in 9/11? What changes have been made in the relations between the Saudis and the U.S. since then that might change that role?
Well, as some of you probably know, President Biden just recently did additional declassification of some of the Saudi FBI investigation. There's still more to come. There is, those two hijackers I mentioned who were landed in California, they are different than the other 17. And because they had a tremendous number of contacts with people who had themselves deep contacts in the Saudi government, I think we're still trying to get to the bottom of just how high that went. Those two, if you read about those two, there are just patent lies being told about that. One Saudi government official tells the FBI, "I just ran into them in like a 7-Eleven in a mini mart, and ended up deciding to help them." It's just, you know, that's not how it works, and so I can't give you the definitive answer. But I think it's the right question to continue to ask. Former Senator Bob Graham has done wonderful work pressing again and again to get these final pages declassified. The 9/11 families have really been great. And I think the Biden declassification, although again, a number of pages are still redacted, is getting us closer to the truth.
And there's someone who wants to know how you react to people personally react to people spinning these false stories when you put so much time and work into following and finding the truth.
Yeah. You know, as a journalist, I try to remain dispassionate, but I can't when I'm confronted with those kinds of stories. People who are just peddling lies, because I've spent too much time with people who lost a loved one, or who lost a part of their life, or to tell me that, one of these crazy conspiracy theories is that the Flight 93 was a false flag of some kind, and the passengers were taken off the plane before the plane crashed, and it was an act of some kind. I've spent a lot of time in Shanksville. I have a lot of friends in and around Shanksville. I'm friends now. It's a blessing of my life with, I don't know, two dozen of the families from the 40 men and women who died that day on that flight. And so, you know, I get my dander up really quickly when somebody tries to suggest that that this didn't happen or they're lying to us. Part of the problem, the larger problem of conspiracies, is that it works exactly the opposite of journalism. A conspiracy starts with a conclusion and backfills selected information to, purportedly support its truth. We start the other way. We start with a question, and we try and get closer and closer to a definitive answer. So when you're dealing with these conspiracy nuts, it's playing whack-a-mole. You know, I will sort of, at a couple of my book talks, I had people, and I'm always respectful toward listening, but I'll knock down their theory. I'll explain why it's false, why, for instance, the NIST report, the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, proved why the towers fell. And I can go through it to some extent. I'm not an engineer, but I've got a pretty good working knowledge of it. And they will just shift. It's a game of whack-a-mole. You knock down one, and another one pops up. And I could spend the rest of my life, doing this, and it's not that useful.
And there's some about the personal aspects of this, and delving a little further into that. How were the survivors changed? Did they ever come to terms with the situation and their bitterness? Or yeah. can you generalize, or is it individual?
It's hard to generalize. I can tell you five off the top of my head, five different stories with five different outcomes. I was just on Nantucket a few weeks ago with Brian Clark, who was a hero and a survivor of the South Tower. And Brian is great. Brian is about to become a great-grandfather for the first time, and he has a wonderful family life and a successful marriage, and I also know some people who I won't name who are struggling desperately, both in terms of their own experiences and also people who lost loved ones. My favorite one to tell, though, and just very briefly,
You're fine.
It's a guy named Jack Grandkolis, and I wrote about him a few weeks ago for the Boston Globe. So if you look up Grandkolas in the Boston Globe, I wrote a very long anniversary piece focused on Jack, because I had met Jack. I like to tell the story this way. I met Jack in a men's room in New York City, and it sounds worse than it is, I promise. We were both there. We were both there to film something for Dateline, NBC. And I was changing into a suit, and there was this man who was waiting to wash his hands. And I had never met him before. His wife was Lauren Grandkolis, who was pregnant on 9/11 and was on flight 93. And she left two poignant. One especially poignant voicemail on, they lived in California, and so when the hijacking began, she got a voice message off to Jack that was preserved. It was San Francisco time. He was still asleep, so he didn't pick up the phone. And Lauren's voice is preserved. Jack is remarkable. He went through hell and back. He describes a 20-year PhD on grief, but he is a hopeful, loving, extraordinary man who refuses to hate. And he preaches this, and he's not, you know, he's highly intelligent, he's not naive. He preaches kind of a gospel. I mean, it's not a religious-based idea, but a gospel of love. And he talks about all that he lost, his unborn child, his wife, and he talks about love and how the hijackers were motivated by hate, and he refuses to succumb to that emotion that was so damaging. So it runs the gamut, but there are a lot of wonderful, amazing people like Jack out there.
And someone wants to know, was Dave Tarantino ever recognized for his heroism?
Yeah. He doesn't want to be. It's amazing. He did. He was given a medal. Dave was given a medal for his heroism that day. But I had to like fight with him for 6 months to talk to me. He's like, nah, I gave an interview to like the Navy Times. That's enough. Like, so finally, I got him to to sit down with me. He's an incredibly modest guy and doesn't want anything from it. But I think like there should be a generation of boys named David because of him. But yeah.
And someone wants to know if you could please comment on what seems to be a fairly direct line from the 2-year-old girl killed on 9/11 to the children killed by the U.S. during the recent airstrike in Kabul, almost exactly 20 years later.
Ooh. I'd be honest with you, I had never drawn that line. With all due respect, I can immediately think of an important distinction, which is that one was intentional, and that makes all the difference in the world to me. The death of the children killed by that drone strike is no less a tragedy, but the death of Christine Hansen was a determined decision by those hijackers to kill anyone, including a 2-year-old girl, on that plane.
And how did your post 9/11 born students react? Do they get it?
I'm fortunate. I teach really smart, lovely students, but they definitely look at me like, now wait, did you like ride a dinosaur to work that day? You know, like, how did you get there? By horse? You know? And so once I get past all of those kind of questions, you know, did you have typewriters? You know, it's what happens when you read anything in history that's sort of, sort of human focused. Then they're just there. They want to talk to Dave, they want to, can we call Dave? And I say, well, we can, but I'm
I don't think I'm going to bother him just to say, you know. But I do have, when they hear from, I've had some of the subjects, so I've mentioned, Skype into my classes. They're overwhelmed. They feel like they're witnessing history. If Ron Clifford talks to a class and talks about his sister and talks about Jenny Ann and talks about being between the two towers that day, their eyes go crazy.
I want a couple more.
Sure.
And then we'll let you go. How has your own political outlook been changed by delving into the 9/11 narrative?
You know, as a journalist, I've always been a questioner rather than an advocate. You know, I think journalists by nature are a bit oppositional, and so I'm just, I'm still oppositional. I don't identify with any one party or any one ideology. And so I'm not sure my work on 9/11 research has changed me as much as just getting older has. And I think that's had as much an effect as anything.
And then finally, are you giving any consideration to taking on a narrative account of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol and Congress?
You know, I got a call from my publisher about that very thing. So if there's someone from HarperCollins, you know, snuck in here up to Maine for this. So I got a call. I got a couple of calls about that. I also got a couple of calls about doing a pandemic narrative, a COVID narrative, because it's kind of what I do, you know, narrative at scale. And I thought about the January 6th story, and I decided I think that there's a great book to be told there, but I feel like the journalists who were there that day, I was in Boston watching on TV, and there was an enormous number of really amazing journalists, some of whom I know well, some of whom I know by reputation. I feel like just as 9/11 felt like my story because I had been in the Globe newsroom that day and I started from the beginning, I felt it was appropriate to step aside and let one of them, you know, who experienced the broken glass and the flames, tell that story.
Well, I want to thank you very much. It's been extremely interesting.
Thank you, George. Thank you.
And we can't let you get away without giving you the much coveted Mid-Coast Forum mug so you can drink your coffee, you know, in the morning and remember us all the time. Thank you very much.